Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we highlight major advances in multiple myeloma, gene therapy for cystinosis, and experimental treatments for myotonic dystrophy. We review long-term outcomes of aortic valve replacement, strategies for secondary stroke prevention, and a revealing diagnostic case of eosinophilic disease in an older adult. A sounding board explores FDA approval standards. Perspectives delve into tobacco cessation, influenza evolution, and the uncertainty patients and clinicians share when facing life-altering diagnoses. Teclistamab plus daratumumab in relapsed or refractory multiple myeloma by Luciano Costa from the University of Alabama at Birmingham and co-authors. Multiple myeloma is characterized by progressive immune dysfunction and multiple relapses. In a phase 1-2 trial, teclistamab, a bispecific antibody targeting CD3 on T-cell surfaces and B-cell maturation antigen on myeloma cells, showed durable responses in heavily pretreated patients with relapsed or refractory multiple myeloma. Daratumumab, a monoclonal antibody targeting CD38 protein, has shown survival benefit in patients with multiple myeloma. In the primary analysis of a phase 3 trial now reported, 587 patients with 1 to 3 previous lines of therapy were randomly assigned to receive combination therapy with teclistamab daratumumab or daratumumab combined with dexamethasone plus the investigator's choice of pomalidomide, DPD, or bortezomib, DVD, the DPD or DVD group. Patients in the teclistamab-daratumumab group had significantly longer progression-free survival than those in the DPD or DVD group. Serious adverse events occurred in 70.7% of the patients in the teclistamab-daratumumab group and in 62.4% of those in the DPD or DVD group. Death from adverse events occurred in 7.1% and 5.9%, respectively. In an editorial, Rakesh Paupat from the University College London Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust writes that progress in the treatment of relapsed or refractory multiple myeloma has been rapid since the introduction of T-cell redirecting immunotherapies. In their trial, Costa and co-authors found an unprecedented estimated 36-month progression-free survival of 83.4% with teclistamab-daratumumab, along with an associated overall survival benefit. High-risk patients also derived benefit. These results are truly remarkable and represent a substantial improvement in treatment. Severe infections were the main concern. Of the 13 fatal infections, 12 occurred within the first 6 months after treatment initiation. 9 of those patients had not received immune globulin treatment, which prompted a protocol amendment to recommend such prophylactic use regardless of IgG levels, close monitoring of IgG levels, and the prophylactic administration of antibiotics and antiviral drugs. These findings highlight the need to implement these recommendations as early as possible. Additionally, the impressive results of this trial challenge the role of CAR T therapy, which remains restricted globally because of the high cost, long manufacturing times, and requirement for treatment at a CAR T center. In this competition, off-the-shelf availability is a big advantage. Taken together, the results of this trial appear to rewrite the expectations regarding treatments for patients with relapsed or refractory multiple myeloma. We are witnessing a new era in myeloma survival. Hematopoietic stem cell gene therapy for cystinosis by Bruce Barshap from the University of California, San Diego, La Jolla, and co-authors. Cystinosis is a multisystemic lysosomal storage disorder caused by pathogenic variants in CTNS, the gene encoding cystinosin, a lysosomal transmembrane cystine transporter. In patients with cystinosis, cystine accumulates within lysosomes in all organs. The cysteine-depleting agent cysteamine delays but does not prevent disease progression. In this ongoing Phase 1-2 clinical study, the investigators performed a preliminary assessment of the ex vivo gene therapy CTNS-RD04, which consists of autologous CD34 cells transduced with lentiviral vectors carrying CTNS complementary DNA in 6 patients with cystinosis. In this small study, CTNS-RD04 had adverse effects that were largely consistent with the myeloablative regimen and underlying disease profile. White cell cystine levels, an established surrogate marker for the diagnosis and therapeutic monitoring of cystinosis, decreased after therapy. In an editorial, Olivier de Wüst from the University of Zurich, Switzerland, writes that despite the limitations of the study by Barshop and co-authors, small sample size, single group design, heterogeneous disease stage, and limited duration, it is notable for several reasons. The study showed that a one-time gene therapy had an acceptable safety profile, reduced cystine levels and crystal burden after stopping cysteamine, and could substantially lessen treatment burden and improve quality of life. It also demonstrates cross-correction of a lysosomal membrane protein, suggesting broader applicability of gene therapy, and underscores the critical role of patient organizations in enabling representative rare disease trials. Given the limitations of current therapy, these early results justify further investigation of gene therapy for cystinosis, with careful attention to long-term safety, durability of benefit, cost-effectiveness, and economic sustainability. For patients and families affected by this devastating disease, gene therapy may represent a meaningful new horizon. An antibody oligonucleotide conjugate for myotonic dystrophy type 1 by Nicholas Johnson from the Virginia Commonwealth University, Richmond, and co-authors. Myotonic dystrophy type 1 is a rare, dominantly inherited, progressive, disabling neuromuscular disease that leads to decreased life expectancy and has no approved therapies. The disease is caused by a trinucleotide repeat expansion in DMPK, which encodes myotonic dystrophy type 1 protein kinase and imparts a toxic gain of function to the transcribed messenger RNA, resulting in dysregulated alternative splicing, missplicing. Delpacibart etidesiran, del-desiran, is a monoclonal antibody oligonucleotide conjugate. The antibody component targets transferrin receptor 1, and the oligonucleotide component targets DMPK mRNA. In this Phase 1-2 trial, 38 participants with myotonic dystrophy type 1 were randomly assigned to receive del-desiran intravenously in single or multiple doses or placebo. Though most of the adverse events were mild to moderate, 2 serious adverse events occurred. One participant had a bilateral thalamic brain hemorrhage. This participant discontinued participation in the trial. Another had reversible respiratory failure after a procedure considered unrelated to the trial. The results of the trial were consistent with delivery of del-desiran to muscle and amelioration of aberrant alternative splicing in some patients with myotonic dystrophy type 1. The data support further clinical investigation. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, Laura Rainham from the University of Florida, Gainesville, writes that results from the trial by Johnson and co-authors showed that del-desiran was effectively delivered to skeletal muscle, reduced DMPK messenger RNA levels, and corrected alternative splicing abnormalities in some patients. The findings validate the concept that reducing toxic RNA can restore splicing regulation. Findings for exploratory functional endpoints were consistent with improvements in hand opening time and quantitative muscle strength. The antibody-targeted delivery of small interfering RNA described by Johnson and co-authors showed strong potential to address the skeletal muscle splicopathy of myotonic dystrophy type 1. More generally, the trial represents an advance in the field of pathogenic repeat expansions and neuromuscular disorders. However, the occurrence of a bilateral thalamic brain hemorrhage in one of the participants represents a safety signal and underscores the importance of careful safety monitoring in future trials. Transcatheter or surgical aortic valve replacement in low-risk patients at 7 years by Martin Leon from the Columbia University Irving Medical Center, New York, and co-authors. 5-year data from the PARTNER 3 trial showed that among low-risk patients with severe symptomatic aortic stenosis, outcomes were similar among patients who had undergone transcatheter aortic valve replacement, TAVR, and those who had undergone surgical aortic valve replacement. The investigators now report on the 7-year clinical and echocardiographic results of the trial. 1,000 low-risk patients with severe symptomatic aortic stenosis were randomly assigned to undergo transfemoral TAVR or surgery. No significant differences with respect to two primary composite endpoints involving death, stroke, and rehospitalization were observed at 7 years between those who had undergone TAVR and those who had undergone surgery. Secondary Prevention After Ischemic Stroke, a review article by Karen Fury from the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University, Providence, Rhode Island, and Peter Kelly from the Mater Misericordiae University Hospital, Dublin. Ischemic stroke, defined as a central nervous system injury caused by loss of blood flow, is most often due to arterial thromboembolism. Globally, the incidence of stroke was estimated at almost 12 million in 2021, with 94 million prevalent cases worldwide. Stroke was the third leading cause of death and the fourth leading cause of healthy life years lost. Each year, approximately 795,000 persons in the United States have a stroke, which is ischemic in 87%. Approximately 80% of patients with ischemic stroke return to community living. These patients have increased risks of recurrent stroke, myocardial infarction, and death from cardiovascular causes. The risk of stroke recurrence is greatest in the first week, but persists for years after the onset of the first stroke. After ischemic stroke, recurrence risk is reduced by identifying the stroke mechanism and targeting modifiable risk factors. The Global Burden of Disease Study 2016 showed that the top 5 risk factors for ischemic stroke were high systolic blood pressure, high low-density lipoprotein cholesterol and fasting blood glucose levels, ambient particulate matter pollution, and smoking. Early diagnostic evaluation, prompt preventive therapy, and ongoing monitoring are central to care. A 91-year-old man with shortness of breath, weight loss, and eosinophilia, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Pavan Bendapudi and colleagues. A 91-year-old man presented with an 8-month history of progressive dyspnea on exertion, chronic cough, and marked unintentional weight loss. His symptoms were accompanied by long-standing upper airway complaints, including sinus congestion, rhinorrhea, and anosmia, as well as recurrent wheezing episodes that were intermittently treated as pneumonia or viral infection. He had repeated hospital visits for worsening shortness of breath, fluctuating pulmonary opacities, and hypoxemia, with transient improvement after glucocorticoid therapy. On the current admission, he had severe exertional desaturation, diffuse wheezing, and profound leukocytosis with marked eosinophilia. Laboratory testing revealed an absolute eosinophil count exceeding 27,000 per microliter, elevated IgE levels, and evidence of cardiac strain. Imaging showed bronchial wall thickening, mucus plugging, tree-in-bud opacities, and mediastinal lymphadenopathy. He was diagnosed with eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, an ANCA-associated vasculitis characterized by asthma or upper airway disease, hypereosinophilia, and eosinophil-mediated inflammation affecting the lungs and other organs. One pivotal trial, the new default option for FDA approval, ending the two-trial dogma. A sounding board article by Vinay Prasad and Martin Makary from the Food and Drug Administration, Silver Spring, Maryland. Since 1997, the Food and Drug Administration has retained statutory authority to grant marketing authorizations on the basis of a single, adequate, and well-controlled study in combination with confirmatory evidence. Although this flexibility has been used, the authors announce that a one-trial requirement will be the FDA's new default standard. The authors note that the historical reliance on two trials reflected a time when biologic understanding was more limited. But in the modern world, as drug discovery becomes increasingly precise and scientific, reliance on two trials may no longer make sense. The FDA now considers the magnitude of the effect, the nature of the control group, the concordance with biologic correlates, and many other factors as part of an overall picture of credibility. Moving to one pivotal trial will substantially reduce costs for sponsors and speed drugs to market, potentially lowering lofty and rising drug prices. The authors emphasize that this change does not mean the FDA will never require two studies, but that one adequate and well-controlled study combined with confirmatory evidence will serve as the basis of marketing authorization going forward. Tobacco cessation among non-daily and low-intensity smokers, challenges and opportunities in Latin America. A perspective by Laura Yambi from the Hospital de Clínicas Montevideo, Uruguay, and Paula Moreo from the Argentina Ministry of Health, Buenos Aires. Smoking remains a major global public health challenge. Within the Americas region, Latin America has been found to have unusual patterns of smoking prevalence, policy implementation, and public attitudes. Though overall smoking rates have declined, non-daily and low-intensity smoking are increasingly common in Latin America, creating a nuanced public health issue that requires targeted interventions and policy support. Implementation of best practices for treating tobacco dependence varies widely across the region, and critical resources such as national quit lines, pharmacotherapies, and comprehensive brief counseling remain underdeveloped in many countries. Helping people who smoke fewer than 10 cigarettes per day represents a unique challenge for tobacco cessation efforts, since many underestimate the health risks of such behavior, have lower motivation to quit, and believe their consumption is harmless. Limited training of healthcare professionals and inadequate adoption of cessation protocols further hinder care. Evidence for pharmacotherapy among non-daily and low-intensity smokers is limited, since most clinical trials have focused on people who smoke more than 10 cigarettes per day. But recent studies suggest that tailored treatment, including pharmacotherapy, may be beneficial. The authors argue that it is crucial to target this group, regardless of their readiness to quit, emphasize the need for individualized care, and call for targeted interventions and policy support to address the unique needs of light smokers across the region. Antigenic drift and anti-vaccine shift in the 2025-2026 influenza season. A perspective by Sonia Rasmussen from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and Daniel Jernigan from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, Baltimore. Recent headlines about influenza have reported a super flu causing a record-breaking season that is overwhelming hospitals. Although less dramatic, data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reveals substantial influenza activity. The agency estimated that there had been over 20 million cases of influenza illness, 270,000 influenza-related hospitalizations, and 11,000 deaths from influenza in the United States through January 24th. These numbers aren't extraordinary as compared with those from previous seasons, but some indicators of influenza activity and severity have been remarkable. This influenza season has been driven by both viral and host factors. Influenza A viruses undergo antigenic drift, allowing them to partially avoid host immunity, and this season has been dominated by an AH3N2 variant, subclade K, accounting for more than 90% of subtyped H3N2 viruses. Because strain selection occurs 6 months before planned vaccine distribution, this season's vaccine is anticipated to be less protective. Concomitantly, influenza vaccination rates have decreased in the U.S. as anti-vaccine sentiment has become more common, and federal efforts to promote vaccination have been scaled back. The authors argue that influenza viruses will continue to adapt to evade immunity, but that the low level of U.S. government support for global virus surveillance, new vaccine technologies, and promotion of vaccine uptake is not inevitable. Through increasing surveillance, taking advantage of new technologies, and improving vaccine coverage, the United States could substantially reduce influenza-related hospitalizations and deaths. Heads or the tail? A perspective by Jessica Ross from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York. The patient wears her coat in the exam room, though it is not cold. Her skin sinks at the temples, and her pant leg falls on her bony knee like a tablecloth over a wooden corner. These are the things Dr. Ross notices about Ms. J when she walks into the room to discuss the results of her recent testing, which confirms that she has stage 4 lung cancer. Dr. Ross and the attending physician begin to explain to Ms. J and her daughter that her disease is not curable, but it is treatable. The goal of treatment is to shrink the tumors to help her live as long and as well as possible. She will most likely be on some form of treatment for the rest of her life. At this point, they pause and then ask if Ms. J or her daughter have questions. Ms. J is quiet, as her daughter voices several practical concerns, and it seems like they're about to end the visit when Ms. J asks the big question, the impossible question, the question that matters, the proverbial million-dollar question. What are my chances? Ms. J is essentially asking about her chances of long-term survival. The only accurate answer to her question is, we don't know. Survival is affected by innumerable factors. Ms. J's choice of words was apt. Despite all our scientific advances, her fate is, in a big way, up to chance. It can feel like the flip of a high-stakes coin. One side means you're dying, and the other means you're in the tail. Patients with metastatic cancer are often living full lives and coming in for treatment periodically. And almost daily, Dr. Ross sees a patient who is securely in the tail, 3, 5, or even 7 years out from their metastatic cancer diagnosis. And so oncologists are left with a formidable task. They try to tell a patient that on the one hand, they may be near the end of their life and they should get their affairs in order, prioritize seeing loved ones, and think about what matters to them. But on the other hand, they might have a remarkable response to treatment and be swimming with their grandkids in 5 years. If it is hard for oncologists to communicate this duality, it is nothing short of heroism for their patients to live it. And so they practice oncology in service of their patients, living in limbo, waiting for the tossed coin to land. They wish they had more certainty and better treatments. But for now, they will continue to float alongside them. In our images in clinical medicine, a 23-year-old man presented with a 2-month history of unintentional weight loss and worsening abdominal pain and distension. He had recently moved to Arizona from a remote Pacific island. Fungal cultures of peritoneal tissue grew coccidioides, and a diagnosis of peritoneal coccidiomycosis was made. In another image, a high school wrestler presented with an itchy rash that had worsened despite topical antifungal and glucocorticoid treatment. A circular, scaly plaque with papules, nodules, and pustules was seen on his calf. Fungal culture of a skin scraping grew trichophyton tonsurans, and a diagnosis of Mayoki's granuloma was made. Mayorkas granuloma is a localized deep fungal infection of hair follicles that may occur in immunocompromised patients or after topical glucocorticoids are applied to superficial fungal infections. Unlike superficial dermatophyte infections, Mayorkas granuloma is treated with systemic medications. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.